I'm going to call the State Government Finance Committee to order. Members, in your packet, you have the minutes for January 26. Representative Johnson, you want to move the minutes for January 26?
Yes.
Representative Johnson moves the minutes for January 26. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Those minutes are adopted. Members, before us, we have the Arts Boards, Humanities, and Public Television, and so forth. We're going to start with Minnesota State Arts Boards. Ms. Jens, you want to come before us? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Sue Jens. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Arts Board, and I appreciate the chance to give you an overview of our agency, what we do, how we're structured, and how we are investing state dollars. For some of you, this will be a refresher. Some of you know us. For some of you, this might be new information. So you have a number of things in your packet. You also have our response to the chair's questions, and we can get to those later if you have questions about those. So I'll start with just a little bit about who our agency is and how we're structured. We exist in state statute as a board, one of the many boards and commissions. We are quite small. Our authorizing statute is 129D, and our mission is here to stimulate and encourage the creation of performance and appreciation of the arts in the state. I always love to share a piece of trivia that Minnesota was the second state in the country to create an agency within state government to focus on the arts. We did that in 1903, and that's not an error. It was 1903, more than 100 years ago. The agency has changed. Our responsibilities have changed. Structure has changed. But we have had a long-standing commitment to a public role in the arts. State statute outlines a number of key duties. I have highlighted the three that really are our core activities. We are, first and foremost, a grant maker. And if you have in your materials, and I know you have a lot of things to look at, but in the governor's budget on the page one, the back of the first page, it shows you that of the funds that we receive, 94% of the dollars go out in the form of a grant. So we are providing vital support to activities all throughout the state of Minnesota. Secondly, we are a resource for other state agencies, other units of local government, nonprofits, on any matters related to the arts. We get calls about all sorts of things. And then finally, we are the fiscal agent to distribute funds to 11 regional arts councils. I'm going to touch a little bit more on each of these three activities a bit later. We also have rulemaking authority. We finished a rulemaking process just last fall. The board is 11 members. I was joking with Mr. Hultquist that he could tell you more about how those board members are appointed than I could, because he has worked with our agency through the years when he was in the governor's office. Our board members are listed in the, I think you got electronically, our annual report, so you have a list of those members. We have one member from each of the 8 congressional districts, 3 members serving at large. We have a staff of 19. And we have authority in statute to appoint advisory committees, and we believe that this is one of the real strengths of the way we operate. We recruit about 250 volunteers every year. They review the grant applications that are submitted to us. They discuss them in a public meeting, much as you discuss proposals in public meetings. They rank those proposals, and a ranked list of recommended grants comes to our board for review and approval. So in many ways, it's similar to your process. I mentioned that we are the fiscal agent for 11 regional arts councils. We think of ourselves as a state system. And those agencies are not satellites of our office. They are not state employees or state state divisions. They are separate nonprofit organizations. Each of them provides a biennial plan. So right now they're working on their plans for fiscal 18-19. They submit those plans to us. We review them. And then when the legislature finishes its appropriating process, we make block grants to each of those 11 regional arts councils. The system was created in the 1970s. Again, we were the second state in the country to create a system like this. And the goal was really to develop arts activities and arts programming at the local level. And so the boards of those 11 nonprofit organizations decide how to spend the dollars. They decide which programs and services to provide. They decide how to staff those functions. They decide how much of the money to use for grants or other services. They really have a great deal of autonomy. We review their plans. We review their financial statements. We monitor their activities. But it really is local decision-making for those funds. Oops, I skipped one. I mentioned being a resource to other state agencies. I'll touch on this very quickly. We manage the state's Percent for Art in Public Places program. Statute gives this program to the Department of Administration, but since the 1980s, when the legislature created the program, they have delegated authority for the program to us. Again, in the electronic version of our annual report that you received, there was more information about that program. It's been in existence for about 30 years. There are somewhere more than 200 different projects that have been completed in those years. All right, I'm going to move over to, and talk about appropriations and investments. This slide shows you the general fund appropriations that we have been receiving, and it gives you a bit of a historic context. I apologize if some of the type is tiny, but I wanted to fit this all into one slide. On the left-hand side, the tallest blue bar is the state appropriation from the general fund for fiscal year 2000-2001. And we started with that because that was the high water mark. That was the highest amount of money that the general fund was investing in the Arts Board. And in that year, it was that two-year period, it was $26 million. You'll see we took a dip in from 2004 to 2007 and then made up a little bit of ground in 8 and 9. And then since legacy funds have come into play, that general fund appropriation has gone down a bit. And we have roughly been flat for the last three biennia. Governor Dayton has proposed basically a flat budget again for next year. He has included an $18,000 increase in his budget for the Arts Board. And he's earmarked those funds for salary and compensation-related costs that have been negotiated between the state and the unions. So basically a flat budget is in the governor's proposal. This slide shows you at a very high level how those dollars are being invested. And I have to say that this includes both general fund and legacy dollars. And the reason it does that is that in many cases what we are doing is we had been investing in core programs with general fund dollars, and we are supplementing those dollars with legacy dollars. And so in some cases it would give you a skewed impression of what we're doing had I taken out those legacy dollars. So I've left it in. I've given you this because I think the key thing about this slide is it shows you the demand and the level of work that we and the Regional Arts Councils together are accomplishing. In a biennium, the 12 of us together review about 7,600 grant applications. We award about 4,500 grants. Some of them small, some of them hundreds of dollars, some of them very large, tens of thousands of dollars, throughout the entire state of Minnesota. On average, we are able to fund about 60% of the requests that we receive. There are many great projects, many great programs that we would like to support that we're not able to do. So I appreciate how difficult your task is when you receive many, many requests and you can't approve all of them.
And Ms. Jens, if you were to combine the two slides, the last two slides that you did, and you added on the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, you'd be above the high water mark of the $26 million from 2001, correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
I wanted to say just a little bit about some of those grant programs and the kinds of things that those dollars are being used to support. This is a broad list, again, because I'm talking about 12 different entities and how those funds are being used. The Arts Board invests general fund dollars in supporting arts organizations all across the state, really what we call the backbone of the state's arts community. And those are organizations in places like Lanesboro and Wilmer and Mankato and Duluth and Fergus Falls and Rochester and in the Twin Cities. We also are investing funds in capacity building, professional development, career development for individual artists. We believe that artists really are the heart and soul of anything that happens in the arts in Minnesota. And so we invest in them and in their ability to reach audiences, to advance their careers, and to produce the work that we all enjoy. The regional arts councils are using funds in all of these various kinds of grant programs. Again, these are general fund dollars that are being used. So a project grant might fund, and I picked out a few examples, it might fund the Cherry Creek Days in Cleveland or Art in the Hollow in Sweet Hollow in St. Paul. Capacity building or organizational support, that might be hiring a part-time staff person. That might be working with a consultant to develop a fundraising plan or a board development plan or a strategic plan. Organizations like the Namath Art Center in Park Rapids, Friends of the Arts in St. Louis Park, River City Theater, Manterville Art Guild, and more that I won't take time to name today, but organizations that are building their capacity to be successful and to serve their audiences. And again, investing in artist capacity building, workshops, training, opportunities that will help them advance their careers, possibly working with a mentor artist. And even in one of the regional arts councils, the one that serves the St. Cloud, Sartell, Sauk Rapids, Foley area, they're investing in really talented high school students and giving them small grants to work with a professional artist as a mentor. So just a real range of activities are being supported. You have in your materials, and I'm just about to wrap up, you have a one-pager that aligns the things that we believe the arts are contributing to the state to some of the state's core outcomes. And I just gave you that as background, but that's my segue to my final slide, which we believe is one of our primary outcomes, which is that we reach and serve so many Minnesotans. And when I say we, I mean the Arts Board and the 11 Regional Arts Councils together. If you add up all of the individuals that were participants in some sort of an Arts Board or Regional Arts Council-funded activity in the last biennium, it's 25 million people. Our reach is broad, and of those, 6 million of them are young people. We're investing in the talents of children. We are investing in activities that bring communities together. We're investing in activities that help generate economic income across the state of Minnesota. And we believe we're investing in things that make Minnesota a really attractive place to live and to work. So a very high-level snapshot, very quickly touched on many things. I'm happy to respond to questions either about the presentation or the materials, and I'm happy to follow up with any of you if you have other questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jens. We have Representative Nash.
Good evening or good afternoon, Ms. Jens. A couple questions. You said that you've got rulemaking authority, and if you would give us a detail as to what is the nature of your rulemaking authority.
Madam Chair, Representative Nash. The rules that we put into place generally outline who is eligible to apply for funds and the way that funds can be used. We also have rules related to the Percent for Art program, so the guidelines of how a Percent for Art program can be implemented, who can apply, who can participate in that program are outlined in rules. And then the third area of rules is related to our relationship with the regional arts councils. How is a council designated? What do they need to do to qualify for funding? What kind of reporting do they have to provide? So it's really trying to define better what a Minnesotan might be able to, or how a Minnesotan might be able to interact with us and with the funding we have available.
Senator Nash?
Madam Chair, thank you. Question regarding your operating expenses. This is the question I ask everybody. You've probably already gotten the note expecting it. Where is your IT spend, and how do you come to arrive at the numbers that you're going to need, and is Minute giving that to you? Help us understand that, if you would.
Ms. Jen.
Madam Chair, Representative Nash. The Arts Board has one person in our office who is a Minute staff person. That person was with us before the Minute consolidation, so we have one position that is on site. The other costs are Minute costs, Minute charges that are levied on us. We are using wireless. We're using local area network services, those sorts of things. As far as increases, our actual costs for 15 and 16 were right around $200,000 each of those 2 years. For 17, our costs are projected to be at $240,000. And I believe That minute includes anticipated projected usage, so we're only actually charged for what we really use. So some of that 240 we may not actually use. And then in 18 and in 19, the projected costs for IT are about $280,000. And I will admit I'm not able to give you a good answer for why those projected costs are what they are. I will say that our own costs, we don't have a server. We use, you know, we use the cloud. We use a lot of central services, and I think that those rates are being set centrally. And so if there's more detail, I'd be happy
Madam
to
Chair, thank you, Ms. Jens. If you would, and I've asked this again of everybody, if you would help us understand by providing what you've been given and told as the here's what you're going to need and here's what you should be accruing for, if you could help us by getting that to the committee administrator or myself or Chair Anderson or all of us, that'd be great. And then, Madam Chair, one more question. Your grant administration, we've heard, oh, gosh, 2 years ago, I believe it was, that in every grant that's issued, there's an administration fee that gets taken by the administration. Are you doing that as you disseminate grant money or not?
Madam Chair, Representative Nash, no, we aren't. I'm not quite sure.
When you give the grants to the regional art councils, are you applying an administrative fee of 2 to 3% on those?
No, Madam Chair, we are not.
Representative Nash.
Once again, Madam Chair, answers my question or asks my question for me. That was the nature of the question. Is in other departments that we've spoken with, grant administration, there's a peel off to cover all the things that they were doing. And then I did have one last question. So in your operating expenses in the governor's recommendation versus your forecast 18-19, can you help us understand the very large difference between the two?
Ms. Jens.
Madam Chair, Representative Nash, are you talking about the governor's budget document?
Yep. So you have expenditures by category. You're at 421 for 18, fiscal year 19, 379. Then you go up to 1049 and 1054 in the governor's recommendation. And I'm just wondering what that is so that we can understand that better. That's on your page 3 of your agency expenditure overview.
Ms. Jens?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure I'm looking at the same thing that you are.
So you've got your table of contents, Minnesota State Arts Board.
Yes.
Page 3. Then you've got expenditures by category, operating expenses. Your forecast has gone up. You've got forecasted base 18 to 19, and then the governor's recommendation for 18 to 19. And I'm sure you've been consulted on that or at least told what that is, and maybe you could shed some light on that because that's a fairly hefty jump.
Ms. Jens?
Madam Chair, Representative Nash, thank you for that, and thank you, Mr. Holtquist, for pointing out the line. The reason you see the jump is that in the forecasted base, it is only general fund dollars because legacy dollars are not part of base. But because the governor is making a recommendation for legacy, he also included legacy costs in his governor's recommendation. So what you're seeing is the combined, but in the column that shows forecasted base of 421 and 379, that's general fund only.
Okay. Representative Nash?
I think I'm running out of questions, so I'm good for now.
I'm just curious, you had mentioned that in the, I think it was the 2014-2015 year, you said it was $215,000 as your cost for IT. What was it starting from the 2011-2012 year and then going forward?
Madam Chair, I actually brought that along. I wanted to be prepared. I didn't go back quite that far. I went back to 2014 because 2014 for us was the year before consolidation. And what we show in our records is $27,000 for actual costs plus a staff person. So 27 was direct costs of equipment and those sorts of things. And then we had, in 2014, we had two staff people who were in our agency. And then with consolidation, we now have gone down to one person who is in our agency, and then we're purchasing those services centrally.
So, but say that again to me. So then you're saying at 2014-2015, what was your total IT cost prior to consolidation?
2014, the direct costs for IT were $27,000 plus two staff persons. So that would be another 130 for two staff positions. In 2015, after consolidation had come into play, we our cost then, pardon me, for that year was $200,000. So it did go up a bit from 2014 to 2015.
And then you were also reduced to one IT staff.
That's correct. And that was not imposed on us by minute. That was a change in some of the our tasks at the Arts Board.
Okay. Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Director Gins. In the OLA audit report, there appears to be some issues with noncompliance with state grants procedures and statutes. And as you know, maybe you can't fully clarify that here, but I think it'd be good for the committee to actually see the response of whether it's not that compliant. And mainly it had to do with grants going to and through the regional arts boards or councils. And so that would be nice to have that information. And then they also went into oversight to the grantees. And frankly, there was some out-of-state. You know, a good example was the out-of-state travel, and dates didn't match up with events. And it appeared as if there may have been some additional in that. And then I did have a question. It appears as if, and you mentioned before to the committee just earlier, that the governor has a general fund budget. And there are items listed in the general fund budget that also are showing up as being paid for out of legacy funds. And to me, that seemed a little bit confusing that you would be doing that, because there's the supplement. You know, there's that thing that the legacy is in order to promote new and broader. And if we're just using it to pay part of our general fund budget items, that doesn't seem to quite cover the spirit. So I'm not sure what you have to cover offline later to the committee and what you might be able to enlighten us at this moment.
Ms. Jones?
Madam Chair and Representative Kwan, I'm happy to have a longer conversation with you about this, and I know that the committee has others to testify today, but I will say a couple of things about that. To your first question about the compliance with grant procedures, the auditor's finding was that we were not documenting the review of the Regional Arts Council's reports. We receive many reports from them. We receive financial information and narrative reports. And we were reviewing them, but we weren't writing down, we have reviewed this and these were our comments. We were doing more of a conversation with them about any issues that we might have found. And so the auditors said to us that they felt it was important for us to be documenting that, to write down that the reports had been reviewed, and if there were any issues that had been found, that we would write those down so that there would be a paper file of that, which we are now doing. We've started to do that. The other thing that they asked us, that they pointed out, is that we ought to be reconciling. Even though each of the regional arts councils has a certified audit, they wanted us to do reconciliation of the funds, and we are doing that this year as well. So that's we believe we are addressing that finding. It's not completely finished yet, but we are on our way to getting that particular finding completed. There was an issue about grant compliance with two grants. Those were legacy grants, and I don't know if you want me to address that today. I certainly would be happy to do that, or we could talk offline.
I think it would be good to talk offline, mm-hmm. since that's not under our purview. So. Okay. Representative Kwan, any follow-up?
I think I'll take that offline.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Ward?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Director Gins. Thank you for being here. I would like to just get a little bit more, and if need be, maybe we can talk separately, but I'd like to get a little bit more information. I know what artists in the schools are, and I'm very grateful that you're doing that. I'm wondering if there's any coordination in terms of education, arts education in the schools with this or beside this, and what are the scholarships for? And I'm assuming the consulting, training, and organization development are for the regional arts boards, but I'd like an explanation of that, too, please.
Ms. Jones?
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, your question first about the schools, the work with schools. Generally, what we're trying to do with the funds that we have available is to supplement what's available already in the curriculum. The state has education standards. There are certain courses that need to be taught. There are certain requirements that a student needs to have. And we have believed that those are the requirements that the Department of Education is responsible for meeting. And so the funding that we can provide would enhance that in some way. Now, there are some projects, there are some programs where maybe it's an arts integration program where you're working with the social studies teacher or the math teacher on using art techniques to enhance those. But we don't see the funding that we have available as a substitute for what comes through the school formula. At least that's not our intent. And it does go back to Representative Quam's question about supplement versus substitute. And now I'm forgetting the next question. Oh, about the student scholarships. Those are, I think, three or possibly four of the regional arts councils offer those scholarships. Those are not arts board programs. And often it's for a high school student who might have an artist that they would like to work with or maybe go to summer band camp or maybe take advantage of some other opportunity that would help them. They might be thinking about a career in the arts, and they might need a little bit of extra money to take advantage of an opportunity. And then I remember the third question now. It was about organization development, capacity building. Those also are grant programs offered by the regional arts councils, and it's part of that role of local arts development to say, here's an organization that perhaps has been volunteer-driven for many, many years, and maybe if they had a board development plan, maybe they could be a little stronger. Maybe if they had a fundraising plan, it might help them increase the activities that they're producing. And so those grants are really intended to help them strengthen their organization so that they can be more successful and offer more programs.
Ms. Ward, or Representative
Thank
Ward?
Thank you.
Representative Green?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Jones, this is the same question I think you got. Not a question, a request. That I asked you last session. Could you provide me and whoever else wants it with a breakdown of all the grant recipients in the categories that they received their grants from? I know it was like 300 pages last year, but I'm sorry to say I didn't get through all of it, but I got through most of it, and I'll be doing that again. So if that makes sense to you, if I could get that from you, and then also maybe a breakdown of this is going to be really hard, I know, but a breakdown of how much you estimate was from legacy and how much from state government finance.
Ms. Jones?
Madam Chair, Representative Green, we can indeed provide that for you. We can get it to the committee, and you're welcome to share that with others. You're right, it is a very long list of all of the grants, and we can break out legacy versus general fund dollars for you.
All right. I just have one last question for you, Ms. Jones, before we let you go. I have a question on the chargeback piece. You've got it noted in here that MMB will be providing those details, but I'm sure that you know the answer right off the top of your head. So have you done a chargeback to the governor's office? I know a lot of the agencies had. Has there been any chargeback for the federal issues or anything to that to your board at all?
Madam Chair, I'm not aware of any chargebacks. The three places where we pay another agency, we pay state indirect costs, OLA costs, MMB costs, those sorts of things are in our indirect cost rate, and that's generally been assessed on legacy dollars, not on general fund dollars. We also pay the Department of Administration for services of, they call it FMR, Financial Management and Reporting. We're part of the SMART program, and so they help us with accounting, and we pay them for that service.
If you could provide those details to us and email them to us, I'd appreciate that piece. I know it's part of your budget that you have on the system, but I think it would be helpful for us to know all that detail. So thank you. With that, members, we're going to move on to Minnesota Humanities Center. Mr. O'Fallon, you want to come forward?
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
I'm David O'Fallon, president of the Minnesota Humanities Center, and you do not have a PowerPoint from me. You have an old-fashioned bunch of paper handout, so I'd like to just talk you through that. And you have some objects up here, which I'll speak to very briefly. So the very first page is the appropriation and how we spend it. Let me say just for a moment that we're a bit of an outlier in terms of appropriation. We are a nonprofit organization chartered by the state. So we are able to act in a somewhat entrepreneurial, business-oriented manner. And I love saying this because it's the truth. We don't license anybody. We don't regulate anything. I have no authority. So the test for me of all of our programs is, are we doing something that other people actually find valuable? Are we doing something that is useful to the great needs and the people of the state? And the short answer to that is yes. Thousands of people, in fact, turn to us and use us. The top page that you will see on here, I will use this to illustrate some of the programs that we do. There's the Minnesota Humanities Center State Operating Budget Appropriation, and you see several boxes here. On the left of that top page is a state operating appropriation for us. That's $350,000 a year, plus a one-time appropriation this last year, a special appropriation to our Veterans Voices program. The three major needs that the center is responding to right now are, we created a Veterans Voices program. We're responding to the educational needs of the state, which I'm happy to go into. And we're creating other programs consistent with our mission, which is to create a thoughtful, literate, and engaged society. I just want to share with you my own view for a moment, which is we are radically nonpartisan. And at this moment in our civic culture, we list, we encourage, and we work to articulate what connects us rather than what separates us. That's the bottom line work of the center, and we try to do that in every single program that we do. So you can see the distribution of the state operating budget appropriation under education and veterans, programs and events. For example, we are helping support the Women's Veterans Initiative. The increased state impact means we spend money on evaluation. I like to look at our programs and ask, are people not only using them, are they applying them in ways that seem to be meaningful? That's a longer conversation. But we're working with the Evaluation Institute from the University of Minnesota on the impact of our programs. And then there's some money for program management and administration. Technology, we do some grant making, but mostly we work in cooperation and partnerships with programs. We have a statewide responsibility, so we do communicate across the whole state. And then there's the core functions of the program. We are an event center. So we operate, if you will, a business center, an event center, where people come, use the center, stay overnight, and pay rental for the facilities. And we have nonprofit rates and corporate rates as well as a way to bring people together. And then on the far right side of that fund distribution page, you'll see a pass-through appropriation, if you will, for a program called Healthy Eating. We subcontracted with another organization called Hunger Solutions. And I want to use this as an example of the center because I want you to know the spirit that I operate the center in. Because we're a private nonprofit, we get audited by a private auditing firm. Our overhead runs 10% or less every year. So when we took over Healthy Eating, we were able to increase the amount of money going into the hands of people who could spend it on actual vouchers, market bucks for eating. So I'm proud of the numbers under there. I think we run a lean organization. My real statement, I don't mean it as a joke, but it's true, is we're one bureaucrat deep. And he's sitting here in front of you, so you can have at me. The back page is some of the organizations that have used the event center and some of the pictures of the center. we didn't make it on this page, I think, because just a week or so ago we convened the St. Paul Police Department, Black Lives Matter, other community members in an important conversation about how can we actually listen to and connect with each other. And the St. Paul Police presented their community engagement program, and members of the community were able to engage in a dialogue about how we can do that. Following that, you see some maps that give some idea of the reach of our state, of our programs across the state. Various programs are identified by different numbers, and I just want you to know that these numbers indicate real programs and events that occurred. It's not that O'Fallon drove through town and gave a noon-hour talk to the Kiwanis Club or something. This is a real program. We invested there. And in every one of these, we try to build partnerships with the community. So my goal is not just deliver a program. My goal is to build partnerships and relationships so that the communities we work with, whether they're veterans or educators or our program now and helping people in many communities understand their relationship with water, we increase the capacity, build new partnerships, and create a stronger level of dialogue among everybody that's working with us. That's the spirit of the program. The Veterans Voices program I'm especially proud of right now, and as most of you know, but I'm going to mention it again, the state of Minnesota is the only state that has created October as Veterans Voices Month, the whole month. We're the only state to have done this, and that will last forever, and Representative Detmer was one of the authors of that program. So we continue to invest, especially in the veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, but not only. We have a major project coming up, and we'll be collaborating with the next presenter's public broadcasting on Vietnam, which, as many of you know, is still alive among us, one of our most controversial wars, and the men and women who fought that deserve honor and respect and understanding, and that's the work of the center. We'll be taking that up in collaboration with many partners. Just a couple of weeks ago, we hosted 50 Vietnam veterans for breakfast, because every program we start first with the community and the relationship to design the program rather than I'm trying to sell you a program. So we build this from the bottom up rather than I have a great idea, let me try to sell it to you. So everything we do is sort of bottom up, if you will. We describe the Veterans Voices program. You'll see an education strategy described in here. We have a slightly different view. Again, we don't regulate anything. We don't license anybody. I don't have a certification I give to anybody. But I've done a lot of work in education, national, even international, and, of course, across the state. And we just think we should look at the, I think probably the committee's heard of the achievement gap. Would that be a fair estimation? Sorry to be snarky, but I think that we've defined the problem in the wrong way. There's an achievement gap, but it's a symptom of the problem. So we think that we reframe the problem, and I know this will sound simplistic, and I'm happy to go into it with anybody at any depth, but the research shows that there's a relationship gap beneath the achievement gap between the teacher and the student and between the school and its community as well. Some things have broken down in terms of local connections and relationships, and even between educators and students. So we've reframed that. We do a lot of original work in that. We create original material such as Blue's Vision, an anthology of black writers in Minnesota. We created this work, and it was published by the Minnesota Historical Society Press, and I'm pleased to say within months it went into a second printing. Now, this is expenditures beyond the appropriation from this organization, or I should say from this committee, but I want you to know the money you give us through the state operating grant keeps the doors open, and because we are entrepreneurial, we multiply that money, we raise other private funds, we leverage what we do with other organizations to create things like Hmong women describing their third generation life coming back and being American and holding on to your culture, standing down a program with the Great Books Foundation. Men and women returning from war have been returning from war for thousands of years. This is full of great literature from, in fact, the Trojan War through now that is useful for men and women returning now and finding their way back into this culture that we've all created. I would only like to say that we take this entrepreneurial spirit into everything we do, with this sense of first working with the community on programs and on needs that they believe need attention, rather than us describing something and promoting it. We've created 1,000 new and original resources from the multiple cultures of this state that are now mostly free and online to all the educators broadly defined across the state. I could pause there, Madam Chair, and take any questions that people might have.
Thank you, Mr. O'Fallon. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. O'Fallon?
Yes.
How are you?
Thank you.
Question for you.
Yes.
In your, I think it's your general line item 1000 on page 4 of yours, that's where you've got your overhead costs, like IT. What is your current IT cost?
Mr. O'Fallon.
Our current IT cost is basically centered in one person. I'm not sure, actually. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Nash. I'm not sure that I have a separate, entirely separate budget for IT. We operate basically in using systems such as Skype. We use a server that we contract with, again, because we're not part of the state system. So under, if you're looking at our technology investments, is that the one you're looking at? We say $71,000 there, so half of that would be a salary for a person. The other half would be costs for the server, for using Skype, for, yeah, it's probably not quite half the cost for a person. It's probably more than that.
Representative
Nash. Maybe we can follow up on offline.
I'm sorry. Yes.
Yeah, let's do that later. And that's what I got for now. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Guam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for the, you know, the colorful state maps. I don't see a lot down in the southeastern part. I notice you've got quite a few different cities listed. I don't see Rochester designated on there. And over the last few decades, I've been to many roundtable where veterans come and speak. And unfortunately, in the last few years, there are people that I miss that are no longer here. Mm-hmm. And so I'd like to understand the Veterans Voices program impact. How do you cooperate, or, you know, I'm just surprised that there isn't anything showing down in Rochester, because, you know, that little medical facility basically grew out of the need to support, military exams. They have a Soldiers Field Memorial. They're not very far from a brand new veteran cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm familiar with a lot of veterans down there, and I'm just trying to, how can I get them engaged, or, you know, since it isn't showing on your maps and material.
Mr. O'Fallon.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, all these dots show are the programs that have been designed by the veterans who work with our center. And there are programs that are far beyond this. We've actually had participation from the Rochester area, but we haven't had a grant awardee. For example, Representative Quam, we hire, and I'm in the process of hiring a new person, we hire a veteran as our veterans program officer, and she's not able to join me today, but some of you know Trista Mosta-Castillo was our programs officer and got hired away to do another job. We are right now looking at 30 different applicants from veterans who will become the program officer. So they design, in some ways, the project and the program. So some of what you identify are services for veterans going forward that our center looks for an unmet need. And one of the unmet needs that veterans have had that we've been supplying or designing programs to meet has been the capacity for veterans, and that's why we call this Veterans Voices, to tell their story in their own voice. Not seeking therapy. We're pretty clear that we're not a therapeutic center, but we're a center in which veterans can speak their own truth, their own voice, their own reality, whether they're coming back from Iraq or Afghanistan or whether they were in Vietnam. And that's been sometimes a missing element, if you will, going forward. So we, for example, however, did just complete a program at the invitation of General Shillitoe we created a whole curriculum around the memorials around the Capitol, because we didn't want the memorials to be something that people just walked by and looked at once or twice and didn't really understand. So we're looking for ways to extend the Veterans Voices program, because there are, for example, as you point out, memorials and ways in which veterans have been appreciated in other communities. Can we cooperate with anybody to deepen the public understanding of what that memorial really tells us, how that indicates what the history and the context and the culture and, frankly, the personal cost to the men and women who were there?
I think you have your homework assignment, Representative Huang. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your presentation. And I regret not having been at the open house that you had the other night. I was unavailable, so I've never been to your facility, so I look forward to doing that at some point here. I have a couple of questions. The first is with regard to federal funding, mm-hmm. and I see that you do receive federal funding, and I'm wondering if you could just, you know, quickly share, and if you don't have it right now, we could meet aside. But from what entities do you receive federal funding? And it's kind of hard to look at the black and white graph here to see what percentage or dollar amount you receive in federal funding, so anything you could share would be great.
Mr. Fallon?
Madam Chair and Representative Pugh, yes, we do receive federal funding. It's not represented on here at all.
I think he's referring to...
Oh, you're referring to...
I'm actually looking
yeah, sorry,
here, but I
got the MMB right.
But I am looking at right. the graph that I believe you just held up, and I noticed on the lower right hand, the far right here,
yes.
the healthy eating
yes.
and the SNAP program, and I know that that's a... I believe that's a federal program.
No, those are simply yeah. participants in that program. This is all state funding on that. So this was a one-time appropriation to the center for that particular program.
Okay.
Madam Chair and Representative, yes, we are the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. That number is approximately each year from the Endowment for the Humanities, $750,000. Am I nervous? Yes. I thought I would just mention that. We don't know yet what the appropriation will be, but it's been extremely helpful to us as we reach across the rest of the state.
Representative Pugh?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so would I be able to meet with you separately to hear how you've spent those federal resources before and what components of your programming?
I'd be delighted to meet with you, Representative, please.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have one other unrelated question. Thank you, Madam Chair. As I recall, the library in Chanhassen has hosted community education events like the Great, I can't think of the exact name of the programming, but I'm wondering if that's something that you are continuing to do as outreach to the community. I see the handout here with regard to education. I was looking at it, but I didn't see that in here.
Mm-hmm. Mr. O'Fallon.
Madam Chair, Representative Pugh, yes, we have often collaborated with libraries, and we expect that we will be doing it again. You might remember, and perhaps this was the program that you're recalling, a couple of years ago we did a program on the Constitution, understanding the Constitution, and some of those conversations were held in libraries across the state of Minnesota.
Representative?
Madam Chair, well, I don't recall that, but I would be very interested to learn more about that, wondering how long ago it was and mm-hmm. what that curriculum looked like. So, yeah, I definitely will want to talk to you about that, which is the perfect segue to my last question.
Representative?
Madam Chair, thank you. So I noticed that your Center through the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund is administering the civics program. Is that correct? Am I reading that correctly?
Mr. Fallon.
Madam Chair and Representative, yes, we do pass through that funding to those civics education, yes.
Representative Pugh?
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. So that clarifies that. I'm interested in that curriculum as well, and I would imagine I'd be receiving that. I could get that from someone else, probably not through you.
Madam Chair and Representative Pugh, I'd be delighted to discuss the civics education program with you in some depth.
I look forward to getting together. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Representative Detmer, you have the last question. We do have three other groups that we need to get through.
Okay, last but not least. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Fallon, How do you get the word out to the state about what you do as a humanity center, whether it's Veterans Voices or any other programs, kind of talking about what you mentioned before? Do these organizations, these communities have to come to you, or how do you get the word out to some of these communities about what you have to offer?
Mr. Fallon.
Madam Chair, Representative Detmer, we use a variety of sources. We do Facebook, we do social media, but the primary one we do, frankly, are personal relationships with organizations and communities and networks across the state. Again, as you point out, whether they're veterans or networks of educators, we do direct mail, we do email blasts. Frankly, we travel a lot. Our staff does visit communities across the state, so a combination of all those factors go into this. But I think for a small shop, and we're a relatively small shop, the strongest element that we have going are continuing to build personal relationships with organizations and networks of information that we have collaboration with. An example, we created the, as some of you know, the with the Council of Minnesota Indian Affairs, the Why Treaties Matter Project, which has been around the state now. It's a traveling exhibit for some years. And because we had relationships with some of the administration in the MNSCU system, they took that particular exhibit to every single one of the MNSCU campuses, every single one. The water project, which is represented in here, is a result of working with the Smithsonian, but also we put an RFP out to communities who wanted themselves to host not only the exhibit, but to create new community partnerships. When the communities applied, we brought and visited every single community who applied to build relationships.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Fallon. Next, I'm going to have a public radio presentation with Mr. McTaggart and Mr. Cavanaugh. I just want us to be mindful of the time that we have. We still have a total of three entities to get through. Welcome to the committee.
Made a neat file.
If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Good afternoon, Chair Anderson and members. I'm John McTaggart. I'm president and CEO of Minnesota Public Radio. Joining me today is John Cavanaugh. He's our director of government relations and public affairs. Thanks for offering us this time today to discuss our Greater Minnesota equipment maintenance and funding request. Minnesota Public Radio is celebrating our 50th anniversary all year this year. We first went on the air January 22nd, 1967 in Collegeville, Minnesota. And since then, Minnesota Public Radio has been working with the state of Minnesota to build a statewide system that gives all Minnesotans free access to our public service and to the emergency broadcast systems that our backbone provides. The system allows the state of Minnesota to conveniently and efficiently relay emergency warnings, information of all types for public safety to all Minnesota broadcasters who then in turn repeat that to all of the communities of the state. We're proud to be a partner with the state of Minnesota in doing this, ensuring the safety of all of our residents. I do know our time is short. I'm going to ask John Cavanaugh to take us through a brief presentation before we answer your questions.
Mr. Cavanaugh.
Madam Chair, members, I am John Cavanaugh, Director of Public Affairs and Government Relations for NPR. Better. You do have a PowerPoint presentation in front of you. We will abbreviate it so that others are able to present as well today. But first of all, we want to thank you. Many of you have already met with us. We've gone through with you in your offices in detail the requests that we have before you and also what we've done with the equipment grants in the past. One of the things that I want to point out is that NPR is the backbone of the emergency alert system in Minnesota. The emergency alert system is vital to keep broadcasters in particular aware of what's going on in Minnesota. Actually, NPR provides the relay to all the broadcasters in Minnesota based upon our ability to do so because we have a statewide network. The description of the emergency alert system is on page 4 of that PowerPoint presentation. NPR's role Again, we provide the backbone thanks to our ability to convey emergency information to broadcasters throughout Minnesota almost immediately. This is possible because of Minnesota's network coverage throughout Minnesota. And to give you an example of that, there's a map, and that map actually shows you our stations throughout Minnesota. We have more than 80 throughout the region. It shows you the ability that NPR has to immediately get information out to others because of our locations throughout the state. I also included one more map, and actually there's an individual map that is in color that I asked to be placed in your packets because it actually gives you a better idea of our coverage throughout the state. This is an FCC map that essentially tells you exactly how far our coverage reaches under a very specific FCC-defined area. It doesn't mean that if you're driving out in Manoman, you're not receiving a signal. It does mean that it may fall below the actual DBU requirement for FCC to or for us to claim under FCC regulations that we cover it. Quickly, I just want to point out on this slide the Minnesota IPAWS is a list of partners who actually have set up this network. It is a composition of several state agencies and also a lot of partners. Among those partners are broadcasters as well. We have been supported and encouraged to come forth by other broadcasters as well to make sure that this that the system is ready to work and is able to function when in an emergency arises in Minnesota. One of the things that I want to point out is because we do have a statewide network, it also allows for a couple other things that you may not know. One is that it provides, we have bandwidth that we can provide to the to DEED and actually the Minnesota State Services for the Blind. That allows them to actually do their radio talking book program, which allows those in our state who are blind to actually receive newspapers, whether that's the Star Tribune or the Pioneer Press. It can also be the regional newspapers as well, and is the regional newspapers, as well as the other different magazines and books that are available. Another thing I want to point out is that NPR is fortunate enough to have some extra bandwidth that we are able to provide for schools to actually receive what's called educational broadband services. This allows broadband, wireless, and high-speed data transmission for specifically these schools. Actually, the reason why I know that is because Representative Pearson, when I met with him, he asked the question, would we have the ability to provide more bandwidth for rural Minnesota? And unfortunately, we don't have that much. We have some, and in these cases, we are able to provide that. But unfortunately, we won't be the solution for the internet broadband shortage that's out in rural Minnesota. Last funding session, we received $870,000 to deal with our equipment. The first year, we received $560,000, and I believe that was front-loaded with one-time money because, again, it would put us in a position to come back to the legislature and make our case, and we're more than happy to do that. In the 2017, funding was $310,000. One of the questions that I know that has been asked is, what are you doing with this money? And we do standard maintenance to upkeep our system to make sure that we are able to deliver the EAS and any emergency broadcasting message and information that is out there. For example, in Austin and International Falls, we needed to install some air conditioning units. These are large air conditioning units that allow the towers to function. In Bemidji and Brainerd, we had transmission line issues that we needed to deal with. And as always, we always have unforeseen equipment failure. There are simple things like antenna lines that we did not expect, but there's also a lot of weather-related damage. Minnesota, although I love it, both President McTaggart and I have done time in Bemidji, we understand how brutal the climate can be, and it is tough on our towers as well. In fact, in Buell, Excuse me. The Sauterville tower site had some damage due to ice on it. But, again, a lot of even just painting things like that. I do want to point out that even if we're painting towers, it sounds like this is glamorous. It's not. The reality is that the FCC has very specific regulations and demands placed upon anyone who has a tower out there. Looking ahead to 2017.
I'm going to pause you there for
yes.
a second. So, Sauterville, where is that?
It's right north of Ham Lake, actually. So it's near East Bethel.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. If looking ahead to what we will be doing with our 2017 funds that you provided, then first and foremost, we need to be concerned about emergency repairs that that we have to deal with. Also, Bemidji and Brainerd, we still have transmission line issues and transmitter issues to deal with. Again, just because we funded it in the 2016 cycle doesn't mean that those expenses don't carry over into the 2017 cycle as well. In Duluth, we have a translator issue, and War Road, Rochester, and Richmond, we have what's called rack mount replacements as well. Again, they're not very glamorous, but, again, they're very vital and necessary to provide the service for the EAS. Looking ahead, one of the things I want to point out about the MPR equipment grant, what it will be used for is maintaining and replacing equipment for Minnesota or MPR's Greater Minnesota network of stations only. It does not go to stations in the Twin Cities. It does not go to programming. It does not go to MPR salaries. It doesn't go to travel and food. It's only for equipment. In fact, tomorrow we have a report due to the Department of Administration that outlines every specific expense that's there, and it also all the invoices that we have also are submitted at that time. Our list for 2018 and 19 is long. We have delayed some maintenance. We also always have a possibility of old that many of our towers are going past their lifespan, so we need to be projecting ahead. That list of communities, like I said, is very long, but right now we are projecting the total need for maintenance and replacement in rural Minnesota or in greater Minnesota is at $2 million right now. Therefore, our request for 18 and 19 is $1.07 million. Again, that's a little bit above what we received the last funding cycle. But again, to address all the needs that are in the system and to make sure that public safety is taken care of in Minnesota, that's what we are requesting. And we're happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Kavanaugh, if you could... if you were to receive that amount, if you could provide us an identification of which facilities would be granted that money from that pot.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, I do not have a prioritized list with me, but I can actually get one, and I will get that to the committee as well.
I appreciate that. Thank you. And then also, Mr. Kavanaugh, I'm looking at your map, and you have two stations that, at least from what I can tell, are outside of the state of Minnesota. One in the Upper Peninsula and one in Iowa. Oh, and then I see now one in Sioux Falls, too. So do any of the equipment grants go to those facilities?
None of the equipment. Madam Chair, none of the equipment grants go toward our facilities outstate.
Okay. Are we just renting space in those places? Or
those are, Madam Chair, those are towers, again. But, again, we do not use Minnesota funds to repair those towers.
Okay. What funds do you use to repair those towers?
Again, that would go back to our, Madam Chair, that would go back to our general fund expenditures.
Okay.
And, Madam Chair, that would be very similar to how we deal with those types of fixes in the metropolitan area as well.
Okay, but then it's still state dollars then that are going into that, or no, not at all?
Madam Chair, no. Okay. There would be no state equipment grant dollars going into funding those.
So it's money that is coming through fundraising efforts, or how is that addressed?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay. All right. Representative Detmer.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to piggyback on your question there, in South Dakota and also in Iowa, those three stations, do you receive funding from those states?
Mr. Kavanaugh.
Madam Chair, Representative Detmer, that's a good question, and I don't believe we do. It certainly is not in my job description to deal with those states.
Madam Chair, member, to the best of my knowledge, no state funds from Iowa or any of those states where we have outside of Minnesota.
So, Madam Chair, and then so what we're seeing is that those funds for any repairing in those stations are, those funds are generated probably here in Minnesota then.
Mr. McTaggart?
Madam Chair, member, the funds that we are applying for are for the Minnesota Emergency Alert System, the Amber Alert System, State Services for the Blind. Where the other state, where we have stations just across the border in the other states, we do not provide backbone services for those emergency services in those states. In fact, we would participate as a recipient in those states. So where we have a South Dakota station, our station there does not provide an emergency backbone service for South Dakota. In fact, we are sort of at the end of the South Dakota line for the folks in Sioux Falls. Does that make sense?
Representative Demmer?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Green?
Thank you, Madam Chair. A while ago, we listened to testimony in a different committee from Minnesota Public Television. And the question was brought up that who owns Minnesota Public Television, because it's privately owned. Minnesota Public Radio, who owns Minnesota Public Radio?
Madam Chair and members, Minnesota Public Radio is a community licensee, owned as a private nonprofit and governed by a volunteer board of community leaders and business leaders who represent the state, who represent our audience, represent the communities that we serve. It's a nonprofit organization that is owned and held as its own independent community licensee, not owned by another organization, not owned by any other corporation.
Representative,
okay. I'm sure. So if you're all volunteers, then are you telling me you don't have any salaries?
No, Madam Chair, members, my reference to volunteers was our board. Our board is not compensated. It's a nonprofit board. And none of the resources, as John pointed out, none of the resources that we get from the State of Minnesota General Fund are used for programming. They're not used for any equipment or facilities in the metro. They're not used for salaries or compensation. They're not used for any incidental or ancillary expenses except for equipment grants related to the emergency broadcast system, the Amber Alert system, and the radio talking book services outside of the metro area. That's the only use of those funds, and we document that tediously.
Representative Green?
Okay, so thank you, Madam Chair. This is new to me, first time on the committee, so bear with me a little bit. Now, so what you're telling me is the only funds you ask for from the state or what you're asking for right now, you don't have funding from the state in any other aspect?
Madam Chair, Representative Green, no, actually we do receive legacy funding, or we have received legacy in the past. However, to my knowledge, that is the only other revenue stream that Minnesota Public Radio has ever received or has received recently.
Representative Green.
Madam Chair, well, then would it be too bold of me to ask where you get your funding? To run the radio station?
Mr. Kavanaugh, or Mr. McTaggart?
Madam Chair, members, we are fortunate to have a very diverse sources of support, including individual members from all across the state who make voluntary gifts, contributions, as well memberships. We have a modest amount of support from corporations and foundations through their corporate giving and the philanthropic activity of those foundations. We have revenue and resources that come from our providing programming to other radio stations that pay us for across the country that we receive. It's a pretty diverse source of revenue, and available on our website, all of our financial data and reports in detail, and we make them all publicly accessible on our websites.
Madam Chair, I have more questions, but I'm not going to belabor this in the interest of time. But I would like to just say, you know, you're asking for money here, and I can tell you that even in rural Minnesota, you mentioned Manoman County, I can go to Manoman County, and if I hit the seek button on my radio, I can get at least 5 Minnesota public radio stations. Should you not get this money, is there any way you can cut back?
Mr. McTaggart?
Madam Chair and members, the money that we seek today is in continuation of the partnership that we've had for many years with the State of Minnesota and Minnesota Public Radio in cooperation with the commercial broadcasters of the state, to ensure that we have emergency alert, Amber Alert, and radio talking book. If we do not receive funds or if we receive less funding than is required in any given year, we are, as a broadcaster, committed to compliance for the FCC, so we will have to prioritize and make sure that we can remain in compliance with those things required by the Federal Communications Commission. We will prioritize and, frankly, scale back which of the communities we can repair at what time, and I'm sure you're all familiar with delayed repair and maintenance and delayed service insurance. If we have an outage in any of those states, in any of those communities, if any of those boxes fail and equipment does fail, it will mean a longer outage, or it will mean that we have to be without service in some of those communities. And that's just the practical reality of it. We don't have another source of funds for the emergency alert system. And as I said, it is a cooperation between IPAWS and Minnesota Public Radio and the commercial broadcasters to ensure that all citizens of the state have access to that system.
Okay. Representative Johnson, you have the last question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kavanaugh, the emergency alert system, are you guys covering, looks like, 95% of the state? Where's the 5% you don't cover? And do you have any idea? And then do they not have access to the EAS?
Mr. Kavanaugh?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, I believe we specifically say 95% of the households. I believe 95% of the people. It's not necessarily the territory. One of the things that, and I think this goes to Representative Green's question earlier, is that even though we may actually hit 100% of the state, by FCC guidelines, we're only allowed to claim a certain amount of our area for coverage. And that coverage on the one slide that I handed out that is in color, it actually defines at the bottom of the page what the FCC requires to call it coverage. And a lot of the times in Minoman County, it doesn't fall under that definition of coverage.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Johnson?
No, that's right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
If I could have Ampers come up next, please. And if you could, Ampers, we're having come up next, if you could be mindful of the time. Mr. Glazer, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
For the record, Madam Chair, my name is Joel Glazer. I'm the CEO of AMPERS, the Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Stations. Mm-hmm. I'd like to thank the committee for having us here today, but also more importantly, I would like to thank you for your continued support, which dates back to actually 1972, and we certainly do appreciate the support of this committee as well as the state of Minnesota. The Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Stations is an association of 18 different community radio stations throughout the state. Today you're hearing from, you just heard from Minnesota Public Radio. You'll be hearing from Minnesota Public Televisions and the various public televisions around the state. We are not affiliated with Minnesota Public Radio or Twin Cities Public Television or any of the Minnesota Public Television stations. I point that out because my background originally was in TV news and then in commercial radio. And being in commercial radio for about 7 years, I had no idea that there was a difference. I thought everything was under the public broadcasting entity. Had no idea that KMOJ was any different than KSJN. And the fact of the matter is they are very different. The best way to explain the difference to you is that if you look at Minnesota Public Radio, it's kind of like a Target or a Home Depot in the good way. They're serving the masses. We're going to be more of a corner drugstore, corner hardware store, where everybody knows your name. We're hyper-local. We serve underserved populations. That means rural communities, for starters. 14 of the 18 radio stations throughout Minnesota are rural stations. Only 4 of them are here in the Twin Cities. We have programming in 12 different languages, Hmong, Somali, Oromo, and many more. We are up to 18 radio stations. We'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. 17 of the 18 radio stations receive state funding. KUMM in Morris does not receive funding, and the reason for that is because they are too small. They do not have they do not meet the requirements in 129D14 to receive state funding. We have expanded to 18 stations. As I mentioned, KRPR in Rochester joined us in FY15. Because of the way that that the committee and Chair Anderson asked to write the appropriation language, the last biennium, while KRPR did join us right at the beginning of the last biennium, they were excluded and asked to sit out for 2 years, so they would be eligible under this next biennium. They were members of AMPRS during FY16 and FY17, but they did not receive state funding. So, Representative Quam, you do have a station now covering your district. They were there before. However, they were not a member of AMPRS. As I mentioned, we do serve underserved communities, and we also have a very strong emphasis on education. Each year, we have about 1,500 students that benefit from our stations. Those are both traditional as well as non-traditional students. Traditional in the sense that they may be a college school or university or even elementary school, in the case of Jazz 88 here at Minneapolis North. But we also have non-traditional students, adults who may have no background in broadcasting, can go to one of our community stations. They can learn how to broadcast, how to produce their own program. They can host. We rely very, very heavily on volunteers, and that's why we operate with such a small budget. In fact, some of our stations operate with as many as 400 volunteers. Our staffing is quite small. As you'll see in one of our handouts here, you'll see that our staff range from 2 to 8 employees. Most commercial radio stations, for example, are going to have anywhere from 40 to 50 for that same size radio station. We're working with 2 to 8, and we're relying very, very heavily on volunteers, anywhere between 150 to in some cases, as high as 400 volunteers. As community educational radio stations, we are not allowed to run commercials, which is part of why we do have to rely on state and federal funding. We are allowed to run underwriting announcements, so if you're listening, you may hear this is supported in part by and hear a funder that we give credit to. So they are making a contribution to us. We are acknowledging that contribution, but they cannot talk about price. They cannot talk about a call to action. They cannot have any comparison, a qualitative. So companies that may have supported in the past, like CenturyLink, for example, have actually cut back because they need to say that their service is $29.95 per month. They no longer want that support, you know, support in part by CenturyLink offering 20,000 jobs in the state of Minnesota. So we do rely on donors and we rely on state funding. AMPRS itself is governed by a board of directors, and each of the individual stations are governed by either a board of directors or an advisory board. It is important to point out that these are all volunteer boards. None of our board members get paid for their time on the board. And we do not own radio stations, and I'd like to point that out from the committee members as well. I often get questions either individually or in a committee. Why isn't there a community radio station in my community? Can you open up can you start a community station in my community? AMPRS does not own any radio stations. We do not build any radio stations. We are an association that represents the community stations throughout the state of Minnesota. So if a station develops and would like to join us, we represent them, but we do not own them. We do not operate them. We advocate on their behalf. We do not keep the money that we are soliciting here. We do not keep any as a pass-through or an administrative fee. 100% of what you appropriate to AMPRS goes directly, actually goes to the Department of Administration, and from the Department of Administration, it gets contracted directly to each station directly. We do not get 1.5, 2, 3%. We get none of that money. We raise our money in other manners through underwriting and in other ways, but we actually bring that directly to the stations. We do not get paid for that. So when I have people say, you know, can't you build the station? Technically, somebody could build the station, although the FCC is not typically giving build permits any longer. In the case of KRPR, KRPR was already in existence. It was being supported by a group of commercial radio stations, and because of a change over there, they were no longer being supported in that manner, and they reached out to us. I will mention, we are not anticipating any additional stations in the near future. We are not actively soliciting any new stations, but more importantly, we aren't aware of any community stations out there that are not currently being supported by AMPRS and the services that we offer. Um, Some of the other areas that differentiate us from other stations, one big one is when it comes to a big emergency taking place. For example, something that's very common in Minnesota is the fires in north central and northern Minnesota happen quite often. When something like that happens on most commercial stations and the other stations around, you're going to hear a minute, minute and a half news story about what is taking place. Because these are your corner drugstore, corner hardware store type radio stations, they're going to have a police chief, a public information officer, they're going to be on for 10, 15, 20 minutes talking about exactly where, what is taking place, exactly where the fire is going, exactly what precautions people need to be taking, what roads are being closed, what areas are being evacuated. It's not a quick little minute and a half. There have been situations in northeast Minnesota several times where the communication lines have been cut. 911 was not working. WTIP in Grand Marais was the only one that was able to get the word out. This is the phone number to be calling because 911 does not work. So we have a lifeline of sorts of getting this information out in a much more in-depth manner, and we work very closely with the emergency services of the counties and the cities throughout the state of Minnesota. KVSC in St. Cloud also offers the Minnesota Audio newspaper that goes out to 400 receivers throughout Minnesota in that regard. We also have a very strong commitment to education. In fact, it's so strong that it's part of our name, Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Stations. I mentioned the fact that we are a classroom for traditional and non-traditional. We're expanding that, and we are now offering, we are just about to launch our new website. And on our website, we're going to have a teacher resources section. And this is actually coming out of demand from the teachers. We have been doing things like Minnesota History in 90 Seconds, Veterans Voices with the Humanities Center. And teachers have been hearing these projects and have been saying, we would love to use them in the classroom. So we are going to start offering them. So segments like this that I'll play that's very, very short will be available to teachers on our website to use in the classrooms.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
Today, when women get their annual mammogram, they can thank a wild doctor. There were dark days when Dr. Joan Wild ran between craters as German bombers appeared over London. After the war, Dr. Wild worked for the University of Minnesota's Department of Surgery. He took up research on bowel failure, a common and deadly affliction in wartime London. But what he needed was to measure bowel wall thickness, and his equipment just wasn't measuring up. Radon had been used in the war, and now a sophisticated piece of hardware was sitting unused at Minneapolis's Wold Chamberlain Naval Air Base. Dr. Wild discovered it could also be used to detect breast cancer. In 1951, Dr. Wild published his findings. Some in the medical community remained skeptical, but Dr. Wild persisted. Today, ultrasound remains widely used in healthcare, everything from imaging to the first snapshots of your unborn baby.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, the first radio for Minnesota's communities.
So programs like that, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds, Veterans Voices, and many others will now be available to teachers. So in a lot of ways, we're getting a two-for-one with the state's money in that it will go out over the airwaves, and then teachers that would like to can use it in the classrooms as well. We're hoping to have that launched within the next couple of months. We're in the beta testing right now and very close.
Mr. Glazer, I'm just going to pause you right there to make sure to see if there's any questions from members at this point. Okay. All right. And if you can wrap it up.
I certainly will. I will go wrap up into our request, which is that we are essentially asking for a flat. The reason I say flat is because we have one additional station. In order to keep that station flat, it would be an increase of $17,750 in our equipment grants. That way all the 17 eligible stations would be getting that same amount, and an increase of $61,500 in order to keep all the stations flat. And, Madam Chair, with that I wrap up, unless there are any questions after that.
Members, any questions? Thank you, Mr. Glazer.
Thank you.
Public television, Mr. Straczynski.
Chair.
Welcome to the committee. And who's going to start? Mr. Straczynski?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bill Straczynski, and I represent the Friends of Minnesota Public Television and serve as Executive Director of the Minnesota Public Television Association. With me today, we have Bill Sanford, who is the CEO of Bemidji Public Television Station, Bemidji Brainerd, and Les Heen, who is also here, who represents Pioneer Public Television out in western, southwestern Minnesota and Appleton, Granite Falls area, and Montevideo, what have you. Also in the audience today, we have Mr. Eric Olson, who is the CEO of Austin Public Television Station. We have John Harris, who is the CEO from Moorhead to Crookston Public Television Station, Fargo, Moorhead, Fargo. And then as well as Jen Schmidt, who is here to answer any questions you might have on the financial information we've been asked to provide to the committee. So our stations are well represented here today, and we'll let them tell their stories in a moment. I just want to frame the discussion for you because what you see before you when you're in a budget request for public television in Minnesota is basically comes in two forms. One, there's an equipment grant category, which is for, I think, a couple of $250,000 over the biennium. I think that's the number. And there's also the other categories called matching grants. Now, we do not receive funds from the state of Minnesota under that program until we raise them locally. And the state funds are basically used to match dollars for public television. Now, funding for public television goes back to the – actually, I've done research as far as back in the 1950s when there was educational public television stations here in the Twin Cities, and there was state funding for that. But it's been institutionalized since the late 60s and early 70s as a grant. In those days, 1967, Congress passed a Public Broadcasting Act, which empowered public television stations basically to create programs responsive to the interests of individuals in their own communities throughout the state of Minnesota. Could have gone one or two ways. Many states form public television stations themselves, owned by the state government, or higher education institutions within that state government. We went a different route. We have community-based public television stations. There are six serving all of Minnesota. Throughout the state, each station provides thousands of hours of educational content for our children and supports their development in reading, science, math, and social skills. And more than 2 million people in Minnesota turn on public television stations each month to access thoughtful, we believe, high-quality content as well. Each station throughout Minnesota provides regions a unique cultural heritage, diversity in the arts and history and politics. And public television, again, is partnered with the state of Minnesota to allow individuals to better connect with their state government. And you'll hear more about that from our other testifiers. And public television stations, we believe in Minnesota, are assets to the state of Minnesota and provide invaluable services that educate, enlighten, engage Minnesotans of all ages. I'm sure most of you are familiar with that. So I will turn it over at this time to Mr. Les Heen, who is the general manager and CEO of Pioneer Public Television.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Yeah, Madam Chair, my name is Les Heen, and I'm the general manager of Pioneer Public Television. And as Bill said, my station is the one that serves western and southwestern Minnesota, the area roughly from the state line, the areas around Laverne and Worthington, north through around Detroit Lakes. We've also distributed to the committee in printed form copies of local content and service reports. Those local content and service reports are something that all of us do every year, and we post them on our websites, and that is a way to get a snapshot of our community service and our programs as well. But in the interest of time, I will not try to duplicate what's in the local content and service report. I think it's worth mentioning, as Bill pointed out, the public television in this state is different from what is in many other states. We have six independent organizations. We all operate within our communities with community boards, and we are all independent nonprofits, and that's what we do. Whether it's Pioneer in the southwestern and west central part of the state, or Lakeland in the north central part of the state, or any other part of the state, that's what we do. We're all independent. But we do work together. And one of the ways we work together, I should point out an example just from Sunday night, for example. My station hosted in Morris, in cooperation with the University of Minnesota Morris, a town hall meeting. And we had folks talking about natural resources and the environment. We had folks there talking and asking questions, calling in questions for a panel. And when I said we were going to do that show, the station in Austin said, well, we'd love it. Can you have the program? Sure. We shared that program with them. Lakeland will air it later on. So we do work together and share programs. One of the programs that we're proud of our sharing record on is one that's familiar to a number of you, and that's called Your Legislators. We have produced that program for 36 years. We rent studio space in St. Paul every week to make that happen. We have one of our engineers who drives to St. Paul every week, puts that show together, and we've been doing that for 36 years, and for many years we have shared that with all of the stations in the Minnesota Public Television Association. We're also producing other programs, and I won't go into all of those, but we do share them a great deal. When it comes to funding, we have provided some funding information as well. The MPT stations as a group raise about $38 million annually, and 40% of that is from public funds and 60% from private sources. The state of Minnesota provides, as Bill Straczynski mentioned, we provide, state provides a $6.5 million, which is comprised of the Legacy Grant, which is, our, of course, Arts, History, and Cultural Heritage, of $4 million Operating Grant, which is about $1.5 million, that's the matching grant, and then the Equipment Grant as well. We also have a contract to broadcast legislative television coverage. We do that throughout the state as well, and that is something that we all share. And we also will have work in partnership with various state agencies on media partners on projects that they may do as well. Across the state, you know, state funding is about 17% of the total revenue, but it averages about 25 to 30% for the rural stations. Rural stations rely a lot more on state funding than do other stations. The other part that is worth mentioning, I think, about the way Minnesota Public Television works is we are transparent. We all put on our websites 990 information, audits, that kind of information. It's all available for the public, for anyone to take a look at. What also I think is what we do that is different is all of us as independent stations, all six community licensees maintain community advisory boards. And these are volunteers who get together, and it's their role to tell us how are we doing. How are we doing in programs? Are we doing the right programs? Should we do something differently? What kind of programs do they want? And those community advisory boards come with people throughout our viewing area, and they respond to what we're doing, and we have good discussions with them and work on what kind of programs we could do in the future. The transparency, as I said, we also submit audits to the state of Minnesota as well every year. Again, in the interest of time, I want to make sure that I keep this moving and a lot of time for questions. I will mention that a while ago I looked at a list at some of the PBS stations across the United States, and I found 158 stations. And when I looked at the populations on those, I did some math and found out that where my station operates is the second smallest town of any PBS station in the United States. We are very much a grassroots, you know, statewide kind of organization that way. And the seventh smallest town on the national list was Bemidji, and that's where Bill Sanford's from. Bill is next.
Great segue. Right.
Thank you very
Welcome
much.
Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair Anderson, Vice Chair Nash, and members of the committee, my name is Bill Sanford, and I serve as both the CEO and Director of Engineering. We're a small station, so I wear a lot of hats, of Lakeland Public Television. Thank you so much for inviting us in to share with you how Minnesota Public Television stations serve the citizens of Minnesota. I'm going to take just a couple minutes and talk with you about how our specific station serves northern and central Minnesota. And while my discussion will focus on our station, it's important that you know that each of the six entities does the same kind of local service in their communities as well. You know, when I talk to folks in our community about Lakeland Public Television, I often use the word local. And our entire focus is on local service. Yeah, we're a PBS affiliate, and like all of Minnesota's public television stations, we carry all the great PBS programs that you're all familiar with. But that just scratches the surface of what we do collectively to serve the citizens of Minnesota. Knowledge about what's happening in one's community is critically important for civic engagement in any community. Looking back 20-plus years ago, there was a commercial local television news service available in northern and central Minnesota that helped people know and understand what was happening in their communities. Big media consolidation put an end to this back when WCCO bought several of the commercial TV stations that were up north. And then CBS bought WCCO, and shortly thereafter, all the local outstate newscasts and reporters went away. We had no local news north of the Twin Cities. This type of media consolidation is happening everywhere across the country, resulting in major cuts in local television news and public affairs programming across the nation and across our state. This is exactly why public television is now more important than ever in providing important local voices in communities across the state and across this country. Back when these commercial TV mergers took place and the resulting local service cuts took place, We were asked by our community to start providing local news, and we took on that challenge. And we've been producing a 30-minute weeknight local newscast called Lakeland News at 10 for over 15 years. And you can ask any of the senators or representatives from our region. It's an important service that we provide to the area. Each night's show consists of local news, local weather, and local sports. We don't have commercials. We do have some underwriters that businesses help support it. But because there are no commercials, it's actually more time than a commercial 30-minute newscast that we can actually provide relevant local content. And whenever I speak to folks throughout our region about Lakeland Public Television, the first thing that comes up is Lakeland News. They talk about our news. They ask about the people that are on. They ask about what's going on. They tell me that they appreciate that service throughout our region. Also this fall, prior to the start of the elections, Lakeland Public Television produced and aired 11 one-hour debates covering state, House, and Senate races from around our region. We provided this service every election cycle in the past, and we broadcast these debates live during prime time on our main channel. And we did that over a one-week period. So we preempted most of our regular PBS programming every night for a week to make sure that people were informed about the elections, and so they knew who to vote, you know, what they were voting for. We also produce a weekly half-hour program called Currents. This program brings people from around the region into our studios in both Brainerd and Bemidji to have a civil discussion about important issues that affect the region. As you can see, news and public affairs is very important to us, and we invest substantial resources in providing these important services. I can also tell you with absolute certainty that these important programs would not exist without the investment of the state of Minnesota. In addition to news and public affairs programming, children's education is another area we focus considerable resources. For over the past 10 years, Lakeland Public Television has produced, scheduled, and broadcast its own 24/7 local kids channel using the best of PBS's educational kids programming. That's something unique to our station. Like kids of today, my kids grew up learning to count and learned their ABCs by watching PBS kids programming like Sesame Street. Our kids channel is important and vastly different than offerings by Disney or Nickelodeon, because every single program on this channel is designed by educators to help educate kids, not to sell them something. It's really important. We also partner with PBS to provide teachers from around the region with lesson plans and materials through a website that complements the educational programming we air every day. In addition, Lakeland Public Television also produces a wide variety of programming focused on the arts, culture, and history of our region. I won't get into details on that. We testified to another committee about our legacy-funded programming, but we do quite a bit of that as well. You know, we broadcast a total of 6 different channels throughout northern and central Minnesota, and these channels can be received from the Canadian border, south to Little Falls, east of Floodwood, and west of Fauston. These channels include Lakeland Prime, which is our main PBS channel, which looks a lot like Channel 2 down here in the cities for those folks from this region. We also have a channel called First Nations Experience, and this is a channel that is dedicated to Indigenous and Native American programming. And that channel is not available anywhere else on cable, satellite, but it's something that we are able to broadcast and provide to our region. Our northern Minnesota coverage area that serves about a 80-mile radius around Bemidji, we serve about 25% Native American folks. That's the population percentage. So that channel is really important, and it's not only serving the Native American folks. It helps non-Native folks understand their culture as well. And I get a lot of positive feedback about that. As I mentioned, we have a kids channel that's 24/7 that's made up of all PBS educational kids programming. We carry a channel called Lakeland Create, and that's dedicated to lifelong learning. It has cooking, quilting, gardening, woodworking, travel, and other how-to programs. We also have a channel that we call Lakeland Plus, and it's another channel that we generate locally in Bemidji by time-shifting national programming. And this channel has no kids programming. You know, one of the comments that we used to get before we did that from folks is, yeah, I tune into your channel during the day, but all I see is kids stuff. Lakeland Plus is a channel that provides the great high-quality kind of PBS stuff that you enjoy each and every night, but you can tune in any time during the day and see that. And we also repeat a lot of our local programs on that channel as well. Then we also broadcast the Minnesota Channel. I think everyone's familiar with that. It's statewide broadcast by all of Minnesota's public television stations. It's comprised entirely of local programming that's produced in the Midwest and in Minnesota, and then we carry a legislative session gavel to gavel. So we're very proud to be able to provide all of those channels throughout the region. The region that we serve in northern and central Minnesota includes some of the poorest counties in the state. Many of the families that we serve are having a hard time making ends meet. Costly cable or satellite TV just isn't a financial option for a lot of these folks. Minnesota public television stations provide universal access across the state to our lifelong educational programming because all of our channels are available for free over the air with just a television and a simple antenna. No monthly fees apply. In closing, I'd like to again thank the chair, the committee, for listening to us today. You know, the unique partnership that has been ongoing for almost 50 years provides great value to the citizens of Minnesota, and I hope that you'll agree that this is a good investment and worthy of continued support. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, any questions? Any final comments?
Madam Chair, thank you. I mean, this committee has always been very generous and supportive of public television, what we do. Any questions? All of our legacy funds are on your own legislative websites with the LCC. Every nickel we spend is there, very transparent. Again, our 990s for all of our organizations are filed with the state of Minnesota and the Attorney General's office. Annually, we file, before we get our matching grant dollars, which you fund, we file our audited financial statements to the Department of Administration. They've got a wealth of knowledge. And so if you can't find anything you're looking for there, please contact us. We'll provide you with whatever information you want. We are very transparent, because we are you.
Well, appreciate you guys coming today. And with that, members, just some housekeeping items. Tomorrow, as you remember, we will not have committee. Or is tomorrow? Oh, tomorrow's Wednesday, right? I'm trying to jump ahead my week. Sorry. So we do have committee tomorrow, but we don't have committee on Thursday. So we will see you all tomorrow. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you.